Hello, this is Bill Chambers, and welcome to another episode of the Faster Podcast. My objective is to interview world-class performers to discover how it is that they do what they do, what makes them unique and fascinating, their success mindset, habits, and behaviors, and share these insights to challenge and inspire you. Today's episode has been taken from the Strength and Conditioning Masterclass with James Goodwin, held earlier this year. This episode is really dedicated to masters rowers, and James will talk you through some of the basic science involved with getting stronger, how it benefits the body, some of the things that you need to watch out for, especially when planning your season with the different strength and conditioning phases that you need to pay attention to, and even how to set up a home gym if you can't make it down to your local fitness center or rowing club. If you'd like to see some of the materials and videos that James references to in the masterclass, these will be up on my website where you'll be able to see some of the videos and download the materials at whchambers.com. I hope you enjoy this episode on strength and conditioning with James Goodwin. James has had a huge impact on my rowing over the last few years since he's been involved in the Swiss rowing team, leading the strength and conditioning, and he's the head of physical performance and the sports science lead there. And I've been picking his brain on all the tips and tricks to get me stronger as I was approaching the fifth decade and also then into lockdown. Great advice from Mr. Goodwin with regards to setting up a home gym, and very impressed with the work that he's done with the Swiss national team. And I think the results in the European Championships are a big part of his work. And prior to James coming over to work with the Swiss team, he was working with the British team. Now, James is going to spend the next hour and a half going through a lot of the fundamentals of why it's so important for masters to keep strong. Okay. And he'll go more into the science than I will, but we're going to be quite pragmatic and bring what is it that you can actually do to make an impact on your life, your health, and your sport. James, welcome to the masterclass. The last in the series, no pressure. Over to you, my friend.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me, guys. Gents, it's a real pleasure to meet you. And I really hope you this presentation and Q&A useful. I think the most exciting thing is to learn that Bill's approaching the fifth decade. I thought he was a bit younger than that, but anywho. So we'll get stuck in. If at any time you want to just put your hand up and ask a question, please just interrupt at any point. It's not a problem, and I can always pick up where we left off. Just on this first page, my contact information, is generally the best place to get to hold of me, is on the bottom there. I can obviously send you that at the end as well. Mainly most active on Instagram. I think that's my decade and I guess generation is the one I use the most, but I've been used there some of the other stuff as well. If you have any questions, just feel free to ping me a message. Cool. Get started. So I just wanted to just give you a bit of background information about myself. So Bill has already introduced me. So my main role at the moment, I work with the Swiss team. So I've done that role for 3.5 years. So I work as the physical performance lead and also on sports science lead. So a lot of that work is revolved around the weight training side, specifically in the gym. I have a programming responsibility to support the elite performance guys, but I also work with everyone all the way down. So from under 23s down to under 19s and Coupe, I basically spending some time with everyone in the system in Switzerland. There's a bit of a mix of things that go on. I also do other bits with kind of some coach education and also leading up some of our more physiological based things. So looking after our physiological profiling. So I'm fortunate enough to have quite a broad role, but as a strength and conditioning coach, it's my trade. Before I worked with the Swiss team, I also worked with the British team 6 years working in the rowing world at the moment. So I was 2.5 years with the British team, sort of mainly in the prep for the Rio games. I spent a lot of time with the men's squad. But my primary role was looking after the kind of under 23s pathway. So very fortunate to see a lot of guys that I've been lucky enough to work with in the British team now, looking to try and perform for Rio, for Tokyo as well. I've been very fortunate in my roles. I do draw a lot of things that I work within rowing from other sports. So I've spent time in various sports, and then from football, the put the logos on there so you can see it's a little bit of my background, but I'm very fortunate enough to have quite a breadth of observing and looking at physical preparation strategies in other sports. So it's a little bit about me. We'll move on to the important aspects of today. So for this kind of presentation, I wanted to cover three kind of key aspects. So a big part of that is, of course, the theory around why is strength and conditioning important. For instance, a master's athlete, I wanted to also add the element, of course, how we apply that. So it's all good understanding. Okay, I know weight training is important. Now, James, you keep telling me I need to do this and that, but how do I actually put that together in real life? So I want to try and give you guys my philosophy as to how I think you guys can go away and do your own programs wherever you are in the world. And then the last bit of that, I wanted to tie both those things together and actually just give you guys some content so you can see what would a typical strength and conditioning program look like throughout a season. And so what I've done is put together three different programs for you, an example program from the kind of off-season time, an example of a program from the preseason time, and then what you might be doing throughout the race season so you have something really applied to go away. And then also including some exercise videos and stuff like that for you so you can really see how things are done. And I hope you find that useful. So we're going to obviously start with the theory bit. I think it's really important to have some of that theoretical background for strength and conditioning. I think the more we understand why, the more we can add a little bit of value. And strength and conditioning is relatively new in the sporting world. It's talked about often in other sports, and certainly in rowing has maybe been a little bit later to embrace strength and conditioning compared to some of the other sports. It's important we consider that and we recognize that we're still learning a lot about how we train rowers to the best level, but I'll hopefully give you some examples from the world of work that I've had with the various rowers that I've been fortunate enough to work with. So the first thing to consider now for me, when I think about the impact of strength training as a whole, I like to think of kind of three key pillars. Now, the first pillar for that to me is health. Strength conditioning training, we know, is massively impactful in our resilience, our robustness, our kind of tolerance to getting injured. That's a huge key factor. And as we all know, health ultimately does drive performance. I can't have an unhealthy athlete that's able to perform. And when I think about it in these three kind of pillars, that they all cross over each other. But that first and foremost one is about health. Of course, the second aspect is about power. And rowing is a power endurance sport. And power is certainly a key word in that aspect of that. I have to have powerful athletes if I want to propel my boat and be able to accelerate. And the third part of that is about economy. So making myself a more efficient athlete as a rower. That's also really important and an area that's often underrated when we talk about strength and conditioning training. So that's what I like to think of, these three kind of key pillars that we're looking to develop and we're looking to build. So I wanted to start the first bit just linking to that health pillar. Now, I apologize if this is a little bit morbid, but I think it's certainly something worth addressing. This is specifically for you guys as masters athletes. Now, sarcopenia is a condition where we talk about the progressive loss of muscle mass as we age. It's becoming more and more of a research topic. It's been identified very frequently in a lot of kind of health research as being associated with a wide range of kind of comorbidities. It becomes increasingly of interest, I think. Even in the UK alone, they reckon the cost of sarcopenia is about 2.5 billion per year. It's certainly an important area. The links are really interesting. For me, there's you can see the little diagram in the bottom left, which follows the cycle of kind of how sarcopenia impacts us, how it affects our capacity to exercise. This in turn affects our capacity for potentially having other diseases like type 2 diabetes, insulin sensitivity, this kind of stuff, reducing our capacity to be an independent person and being reliant on someone. I think the other thing that's really interesting is just around this kind of graph that we see in the top right corner. So this is directly from the World Health Organization, and how actually muscle mass impacts our life. So that kind of first dotted line we see is roughly around the age of 45. What we then tend to see is a decline in our muscle mass and strength as we age. And actually, the best intervention we have at the moment to combat that is strength training. Strength training has increasingly become recognized as our best tool to really counteract some of those age-related diseases. And I think that's really critical. But actually, when we talk about strength training as a master's rower, we're talking about something to impact your entire life, and not just prolonging your life, but also making sure we improve the quality of your life. The muscle mass is related to so many things, so many different diseases. And also, as we do age and we become a little bit less active and we start to see that decline, we can certainly do a lot with strength training to make sure that we negate a lot of that. So it's a really critical topic. And it seemed a little bit morbid, but I think it's certainly something to address, that when we talk about it, we're talking about changing our futures. I think the next thing is to consider is of course, around injuries. Masters rowers are no strangers to picking up niggles. This is actually a really good study, and it's probably the most comprehensive one that we have. This is quite a big study out of Croatia from the 2007 World Masters Championships. And what they actually found, I think they looked at about 700, just under 750 of the athletes competing out of the 1,000 that were there, which is a really good recruited cohort. And about a third of us as Masters rowers experienced some kind of injury. Now, what's really good is that we were able to see a big breakdown of that type of stuff. And certainly a lot amongst male masters rowers, lower back is still the biggest issue. 62% of those are chronic based injuries, and a vast majority of the acute injuries we see are actually picked up from cross training. So people falling off bikes and that kind of stuff, which is really interesting. But we still see that same kind of pattern that I've observed in the elite rowing, is that the lower back is a crucial area for a rower to make sure that we're able to develop that. I think what's also important to consider, actually, some of the broader research when we look at strength training, there's a really good study in the BGSM. It looked at 26,000 athletes. And what we actually found is that strength training alone, an adequate strength training and consistent strength training, can actually reduce your risk of picking up chronic injuries by about 50%, which is, as far as things go and being able to investigate in the sporting world, that is massive. So it's a really valuable tool that we have in terms of our injury risk reduction, and that is critical.
James, maybe I'll just chime in here with some pragmatic, no science based on this, but about 3 years ago, we introduced more hinging strength movements, core back, especially the pelvic thrust, with the Masters group here in Vevey, Switzerland. And we've seen a zero incidence of lower back pain since we've done that. So especially the pelvic raise and more of the bent over rows, and starting to do more of the, specifically the deadlift. So strengthening the lower back and the hamstrings and the glutes, and the lower back pain disappeared. So what was generally related, on the rowing machine, we get rowing related back pain from the rowing machine, disappeared completely. So these commonly termed overuse injuries, gone.
Yeah, it's a really important point to consider. I think it's good, Bill, that you've experienced that in the real world. The hip is a very key function within the rowing movement, and quite often we spend a lot of time training our legs, trying to develop our quads with things like squats and this type of work, but we quite often neglect how much of a role our hip extension plays in the movement of rowing. And actually, one of the things that I've really observed with amongst a lot of rowers is that actually that they're not always as effective as you think at isolating the hips to work independently. And that can quite often carry over within the rowing stroke. If I'm not able to hinge my body from my hips on land, it's very likely that I'm able to actually use this action within the stroke without actually using my lower back to compensate from that. And if I can strengthen up that movement when I'm able to do it at lower intensity, for example, during training, I'm able to be much more efficient with that movement and be much more active and subsequently load the back a lot less than I would do if I didn't have it. So it's good that you've experienced that in the real world. And yeah, it's unsurprising. And it's certainly, I think it's actually been one of the first things when you were asking about your boy, Nick, around what he could do. The first thing I said, oh, he's actually quite strong, but where he's probably a little bit weak is around how he uses his hips and working on those hinging kind of motions. And that's very common, even as we see up into masters athletes as well. So yeah, it's definitely a key area. Cool. So I just wanted to have a quick think about some of the needs analysis just around what it takes for being a masters rower. Specifically talking here is more around those 1K kind of distance regattas rather than necessarily the head racing. Of course, a head race is going to require a little bit more of our kind of aerobic physiology. I wanted to talk about this from a point of view because it really baffles me in the masters world that actually you guys compete at a shorter distance. The quantity of strength and power, the contribution it has to the bioenergetics of the event is actually a lot higher than it is in Olympic distance. But we don't necessarily value strength training still as a tool to do that, even though maybe some of the Olympic guys maybe embraced it a little bit more. So hence the purpose of this slide. So of course, over that 1K distance Masters Regatta, we're going to see shorter world's best times. That's obviously clear. I think when we look at Olympic rowing, what's genuinely argued is somewhere around 70-80% aerobic contribution and a 20-30% anaerobic contribution. Now, depending on whose research you look at and the philosophy of the coach, etc., that's certainly up for a little bit of debate, but it's quite important to consider ultimately the messages that the anaerobic contribution for a masters rowing regatta performance is going to be much higher from anaerobic in our sprint energy system. Strength training, where it has the biggest impact, it's going to be even more impactful during a masters regatta. I think the other thing obviously we also see is that the sprint system, so when we talk about the sprint system, I specifically talk about how we start in rowing and how we're immediately at, how quickly we're able to get to the speed that we need to execute the race. That becomes even more predictive when we talk about the first 500 in Olympic rowing. The first 500 is even what is way more essential in masters rowing in terms of being predictive of finish position. So it's really critical that we actually nail that part down. Just a little bit of background in terms of energy system and bioenergetics. So we actually use, with the Swiss team, we use what's called a critical power model. So for those of you that have spent maybe time looking at people like Steven Seiler and these type of physiologists, you might be a little bit more familiar, but I it's just important to go through this to give you a bit of background to it. So obviously that is we look at a couple of different tests with the guys in the national team. So we look at a fixed time trial test. So at the moment we use a 3 minute and a 12 minute. And the goal is to obtain the highest power. So we have a 3 minute, a 12 minute, and we also have a sprint test. And what on those red points represents one of those tests on the graph. So in the top left corner. Now, what that is able to do is we can draw our power duration graph. We're able to get a couple of key variables. One of those is our aerobic power or critical power, sometimes called critical speed in the running model. And this represents the line and the curve that never quite touches. And this is ultimately representative for us is our kind of aerobic based physiology. Now, the reason I talk about that is because when we talk about strength training is it's not just that sprint and anaerobic that we impact, but it's also the aerobic side. So of course, if I want to split my model into three, we look at a three system model. Now we have our sprint power, which is that high power that we see at the top end of the graph. We have our anaerobic power, and that's the area between the dotted line and the graph. This represents our kind of glycolytic energy system. And it's ultimately, once we go above our critical power threshold, that's the energy we have available to complete the desired task. And then of course, we look at our aerobic system, which is that dotted line, that critical power. That's mainly our oxidative kind of energy production. That's our sustainable pace that we use as our marker for aerobic physiology. Now, the key message is that ultimately we can change all three systems with strength training. And I've seen that from some of the data we collect from the Swiss team. Certainly for sprint power, to change sprint power, I have to be strong. I have to be powerful. It's the easiest avenue and the easiest tool to change that. Certainly for the anaerobic system, one of the biggest things that we found with the anaerobic system, certainly in the Swiss team, is one of the biggest influences is muscle mass. Actually, what happens in these very high intense endurance events is a process where your muscle oxygen saturation starts to deplete during the event. Now, in order to produce high amounts of power, I have to be able to do this quite quickly if I want to tap into those higher intensities. And what we often find is that actually improvements in lean muscle mass actually lead to improvements in our anaerobic system as well. And of course, as we discussed before around the economy side, the aerobic position is really critical too, because when we talk about the analogy I like to use is, for example, I'm running my race at 400 watts. Now, if my max capacity is 700 watts, actually to row at 400 watts uses quite a lot of my system. It takes a lot of effort to do that. As soon as I increase that ceiling to 1,000 watts and give myself that top edge of the ceiling, to row the race at 400 watts is actually much, much easier, and it makes me much more efficient. So that's a key thing to think about when we're talking about how strength training impacts. It's not just about that top end stuff, like getting a big start, being able to hit those high intensities at the back end of the race and really deplete the system, but also that mid-race pace where all the aerobic work is done, strength training can be really influential. I think, Bill, when we've had a discussion before around your own personal side is...
We have. You
talked about your hour of kind of hour of power, should I?
I'll give the class a bit of an overview. So over the last 6 months, I've put on about 3 to 3.5 kilos of lean muscle mass through focused strength work. And one of the standard sessions we do is an hour and a half on the erg, but just to round it down to 1 hour, my split average for a set heart rate, my aerobic zone heart rate of 140 beats per minute, I could pump out about a 2:01 to 2:02 split. The progression over the last 3 months has got that down to a 157 split. I would not say that I'm more aerobically stronger. It's the same motor, but to James's point, there's more capacity and it's far more efficient. I could go a lot harder than that for the hour, but that's at the same heart rate. So I think I've got more energy unit or more strength units to call on, as James was describing. So you should, I'd say, and most of the athletes, even the junior athletes, the stronger they are, the faster they can push for the same perceived exertion and the same of intensity.
Yeah, you said that really well there, Bill. That's the key message there. It's just around making us kind of more efficient. But it's a really good example, I think, from your side, having experienced that in real life. And that's really often what we see. So before I move on to the next bit, just around some of the application side, just to sum up those little bits, there's a couple of key areas that we spoke about. The health part of strength training is massive. And I think it's really something that I appreciate as being really critical, particularly for older athletes, is around the impact of strength training on sarcopenia and maintaining our quality of life for as long as we do live. Around injury risk as a master's athlete, 62% of us as master's athletes still picking up chronic injuries, and we know we can reduce at least 50% of that with just strength training alone. And then from the performance aspect, of course, we know power is important in this sport and almost even more important in master's rowing, certainly on the regatta side, not necessarily the head side. As we've also discussed, you need the efficiency in the economy as well, and trying to improve that rowing economy and being able to do the same output with lower efforts is also really critical impact strength training. I've tried to succinct that as much as possible, because I didn't want to bang on too much about the theory side, but I hope you found that little bit interesting on that front. Just before we move on to that application bit, Sean, Mark, do you guys have any questions around some of the bits that I've just gone through?
Yeah. James?
Yes.
Just a point that I'm 77, so getting quite aged, and I'm definitely at a stage of my life, despite being fairly active and training pretty hard on the water, that every year I'm just getting weaker, even though I'm lean and very sinewy. So I definitely feel that despite taking quite a prodigious amount of exercise on the water and doing other things, I'm simply losing strength. So I back up what you said there from a bitter experience. Anything I can glean from this evening's talk, which so far is fascinating, and thank you very much for what you're doing. Is there any way where people my age can realistically either slow down the loss of strength and muscle mass, or maybe even increase it again without resorting to illegal substances?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think from what I've seen of what's coming out of the evidence, I have a friend of mine who works for a company called Strength for Life, and they're doing a lot of research into how strength training affects older populations. And I think that's the kind of key aspect.
Okay, can I have that in a second?
Yes, sure.
I should add, I don't do much gym work. So I'm training very hard in the boat, doing long distances. I'm very quite hard, getting fairly exhausted, but I'm not spending a lot of time in the gym heaving heavy weights or even heaving light weights. Maybe I should be spending more time in the gym. The problem there with the rowing club is that gyms are shut down during COVID.
Yes.
And anyway, they tend to be very busy. And also with heavy weights, I'm worried that if I start trying to heave, say both my knees are worn out. So things like deadlifts are really quite painful to do. Sure. I'm worried that if I try and do strenuous weight training on the muscle blocks that I feel need bolstering, which is mainly from my sort of hips downwards, that I'm going to do more damage than good.
Yeah, definitely. So it's a really good point. How I like to think about it is that this caveat that the poison is also the cure. Of course, any exercise we do, when we do too much, we can cause ourselves damage. That's how injuries occur. We do more basically than our body has the capacity to tolerate. Strength training is actually a really good kind of medium with that, with a lot of athletes, because it tends to be the thing that they do anywhere from 1 to 4 times per week. It's not the main sport that they do. So the total volume of work that we do doesn't tend to be too difficult, certainly if it's a well-organized training session. I would say to you is that there's still this kind of like cultural element that strength training can be dangerous if you're reckless with what you do. But if you're coached well, if you've got someone that's able to help you and have a look at some of your movements to make sure you've got the basics, there's a lot of sensible training that you can do, certainly at the age of 77, that should be beneficial for you. And I think if I was in your position, I'd be looking at what I'm talking about now and going, okay, maybe I should dedicate a little bit more time to that. But hopefully we'll cover some of what you can do with limited equipment and that kind of stuff at home. And maybe you can take some bits away. Certainly feel free to send me a message at the end if you want some specific ideas. But I would absolutely be thinking about, okay, I can definitely do some strength work here to try and rebuild some of that muscle mass that's starting to go. It's difficult because it's a natural part of the aging process. But what we've seen through some of the research that's around that is actually we can prolong that by as much as possible with strength training. And it's our best tool that we know of that we can do that. Yeah, it's really cool. It's quite nice of you to share that story, actually, because I'm sure like you're definitely not the only one who's in that situation.
I definitely found that doing large amounts of non-strength training, i.e. long distances on the boat, sometimes quite high pressure, makes my muscles get smaller. I think I'm just burning up body mass. Maybe the muscles that are left are pretty strong, but I'm not adding to my overall power.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's there's an element of this is why we kind of strength train in rowing.
Yeah.
When you see some of the guys, like how the sport's changed over the years, the physiques have certainly changed as well. I think when you looked at rowing 20 years ago, there's always been big guys. You see some of the guys that come in now and certainly on the men's side, there's been a very gradual increase in that average body weight because the guys are carrying a little bit more muscle mass. And you can't achieve that just through rowing alone. Like it's, some people can, if they have the natural, already got some natural muscle mass and they're able to build it very easily. But you need that strength training element to help add onto it. And we've certainly seen that working with some of the guys. I think if you, even if you look at, so the guy you can see on the right-hand side of the picture is Paul, who's in the men's four at the moment. And he was in Yale. He used to be in the French team as a junior, and then he changed to Switzerland. And he went to uni in Yale, and he didn't do a huge amount of strength training. And when he first came into the Swiss team, this was the first time he really did a large amount of strength training, and he probably put on 4 to 5 kilos of muscle mass. It certainly changed his physique quite a lot, but you know, he also put on a lot in terms of his sprint power and improving that top end strength. And I have no doubt that without any of the strength training, he wouldn't have been able to do that. That only comes from that specific work.
Okay.
Cool. All right. We'll move on. So I want to just cover the bits just around the application. So strength training can be a bit of a mystery. Sometimes it's a bit of a mystery tool. There's lots of different exercises we can do. There's lots of different sets, reps, schemes, lots of different ways to plan. What I'm going to outline is the kind of most basic way that I've worked with and think is a really good approach to do it. The first bit we're just going to cover is what's typically done within strength training. So this is traditional gym training that I tend to see a lot in rowing, particularly in Europe. I'm not sure what it looks like as frequently in the States. I think in Australia, I'm not sure either, Bill, but I'm sure they do a big endurance circuit in Australia. But this is all really what's typically done. Of course, it depends on who the coach is, what kind of things they bring in and everything else. But normally what we see is very high volume type works. So always high repetitions. This extract is just from the French national team. So you can see a big circuit of lots of different exercises. Regardless of how good your French is, you'll be able to see this certain number of repetitions for each one. It's very much a mishmash of everything. It's always trying to train all physical qualities at the same time. So it's like, oh, it's strength, power, endurance, everything is mishmashed together in one. From my experience of seeing rowers do this type of work, I've frequently been in the gym when people have picked up injuries. You might think actually, oh, the heavy weights, they're the risky ones. But generally with weight training, if the intensity is high, so the weight is heavy, the volume is normally always low when we're doing strength training in the gym. Quite often we have, in this type of stuff, we've got weights, maybe not really heavy weights, but almost been worked very close to failure. And this is where quite frequently we start to have accidents happen. So it's always an interesting one, an important one to consider. But quite often what we see, or what we miss, is that we never really have that specific strength that really focuses on power work, that increases in muscle mass if we need it. They're always neglected because they're trying to do everything at the same time. And almost by trying to be too specific in the boat, actually, I miss overloading some of the physical qualities that I need to make myself a little bit better. I do think with this type of work, so this kind of circuit style stuff, there is a place for it. You can do this type of work early in the season. But I, from my opinion, what you tend to get, it's more of an aerobic type of session. So it's better for building your aerobic base fitness more than anything else, particularly if maybe your rowing training is getting a bit stagnated and maybe it's too cold to go out cycling or whatever it might be. That's where these sessions start to have a little bit more place. But often the adaptations that we're trying to work on aren't always too specific. So that's moving on to my next little bit is when I talk about strength training, quite often people go, oh, what exercises do you do in the gym? And like a lot of strength training, it broadens much more than just the exercises alone. What we really have to think of when it comes to strength training is actually, how do we look at the specific kind of adaptations we're trying to achieve? So these are my 6 key areas that I work on that make up the gym training that I do. I'm not going to go through all of them, but the point to understand is that actually what I'm looking for as a physical performance coach is actually I'm trying to develop these specific areas. So I'm trying to develop improving my ability to produce force quickly, Why is that important? I know that's going to be influential on start performance. I'm trying to develop the muscle mass or size. Why is that important? I know that has a very good link to anaerobic performance. And I know that actually muscle mass can sometimes be a limiting factor to how powerful and how strong I can be. So that's the, you know, that's the perspective that I want you guys to think of, is that when we're talking about it, it's about adaptations and trying to produce better adaptations in the body than it necessarily is about just what, just along what exercises we do. A typical session that I would do with the girls. Now, I will keep a very consistent training flow. I do that for a couple of reasons. Certainly within the system that I work in, it's good to have an opportunity for the younger guys coming in to go, oh, okay, I see this guy, he's in the Olympic boat class. I want to do the same training as him. And it's easy for me to be like, we are doing the same training as him. We all follow the same flow. And so it was almost like a model and a philosophy of training. I think for rowers, for me, from my opinion, this is what I find the best thing to do. Now, every session, always start with some mobility. For a master's rower, that's really critical. Poor mobility around my hip is very influential on my risk of lower back pain. So spending a lot of time mobilizing the hips, mobilizing the shoulders, mobilizing the spine is really critical at the start of the session to make sure I develop that flexibility and I can really help. That's for any session, not necessarily just a strength training session, but that's going to be really helpful for us to make sure we can achieve really good positions in our rowing, that we're technically able to achieve positions that, that our coaches want us to be able to go through. The second part of that is then I do a lot of what's called, what I call muscular conditioning work. So this is our, it's quite slow tempo based training. It's our activation kind of style of training. This kind of acts as my main kind of muscle endurance. And quite often what I find is, let's say I'm Bill, for example, I'm working through some lower back problems. I might find that Bill's conditioning is actually maybe a bit more focused on his hamstrings, maybe his glutes, maybe the lateral parts of his hips, because I know those are protective areas for him to help develop his lower back pain. So quite often that bit, that conditioning bit becomes very specific to the athlete. So it might be if you've had previous problems, maybe with shoulder injuries, you might be spending time working the smaller muscles, the rhomboid muscles in between the shoulder blades to try and develop some capacity in that area. The third part of that is our lifting kind of work. So that makes up the main part of our strength session. That'll typically be things for most rowers, like things like the squats, deadlifts, press ups, bent over rows, all this type of stuff. And then the last part of it is the trunk work. So often when we talk about the trunk, it's not just the six pack style abs. We talk about the whole length from shoulder all the way down to the hip. And in rowing, that's such a key area. Rowing is of course a full body sport. I have to be able to take pressure from what I produce at foot level all the way up through my body to transfer that into the handle. And that's ultimately the motion that propels the boat. So having a really strong, high capacity, well-functioning trunk is really critical. So what I like to do with rowers is, of course, spend some time on that area specifically at the end of the session. And that's the flow of the session that I like to do. The next bit is just around when I talk about like annual planning, what does that typically look like? Now, this is a very basic, what we call a periodization model. And all periodization is, it always sounds very fancy and people like to make a really big hoo-ha about what it looks like and how to do it correctly. But there are many different models that you can use and different ways to, certainly different ways to skin a cat. But ultimately it's just it's an annual approach to our programming where we just focus. So our focus kind of shifts strategically between developing certain physical qualities that underpin another one, while trying to gradually build our performance to peak to a certain level. That's basically what periodization is. When we talk about it in the rowing world for the physiology side, often the winter time will be about building a big aerobic base. That's often low intensity, longer miles. And as we work closer to the season, then that volume starts to reduce. The intensity starts to go up a little bit as we prepare for racing. that's no different in strength and conditioning, really. Now, the preference for me, for most, even the rowers with the Olympic guys, is I like to look at three blocks through the season. So I like to look at an off season, a pre-season, and an in-season. Of course, some people prefer fall. They like to throw in some other stuff. There might be a race element, a pre-season, if you like, a very different bit towards racing, a kind of late winter block, an early winter block, however you want to talk about it. But I like to work on off three blocks. Now, as a general rule, if there are two goals per macro cycle. So each one of these off-season, pre-season, in-season is it's what we call a macro cycle. It's quite difficult to do more than two things, in my opinion, per block. To develop all goals, all kind of physical qualities at the same time, it's not impossible. It certainly maybe dampens down some of the benefits you might get of just focusing clearer on single goals. So my preference is to try and just keep two goals, and a lot of those goals quite often cross over anyway. So in the off season, generally we talk about increasing our muscle mass, improving our muscle mass, and how we do that with strength training is generally with higher repetition work. In the preseason, I talk about improving our maximal force quality, so improving our maximal strength. And this is generally done with maybe a higher weight, so higher intensity of training in the gym, but with lower volume. And then the in-season is about transferring that strength.
And we just lost the connection there with the in-season piece. I heard before it broke up, it's about maintaining the strength and increasing the power. Can you talk a little bit more to point two?
Yeah, definitely. When we talk about increasing power, what we tend to do is then add this velocity element into our training. So most of the kind of power training that we do, a lot of what this is made up of is explosive exercises. I can take a lot of the key lifts that I do. Bill, you might take a deadlift, for example. And we might focus with actually a lower weight, but the focus for you might be moving that bar as quickly as possible. It might also be a combination of throwing in things like kettlebell swings, things like jumps, things like medicine ball throws and that type of stuff, where we add the velocity element into our training. And that helps us transfer some of that power into the flow of the strength that we've been developing through the season. That's the general model that I liked. This is just a little table going over and summarizing what does each of those blocks look like. Now, I think one of the key things is around, one of the messages around strength training is that even as elite guys, we basically strength train all year. I think particularly the key thing around strength training is consistency. I have to be doing something throughout the year and I want to keep that frequency of training quite high. What tends to happen is that obviously we maybe get into a race season or something like that. Maybe we go away or whatever it might be. And then suddenly strength training gets put at the bottom of the pile. But it's almost like to me, how I think about strength training is exactly the same way I think about that base aerobic fitness training. It's about consistency and it's about frequency and trying to maintain that throughout the year. That's how you want to think about it. Now, when we talk about for kind of you guys in your situation, I would certainly say, even if you can add one strength training session to your weekly schedule, you know, maybe you decide, okay, I've got an extra bike ride or something, or I've got an extra steady session, even subtracting that and adding a strength training session can make a huge impact. But certainly where we see the most benefits is going to be around a minimum of two training sessions. When we talk about really increasing kind of muscle mass, we probably want to see two to three sessions per kind of muscle group if we want to really work on that. So what I've done in this table is just outline to you guys what roughly that looks like. So of course for the off season, those two key goals that we talked about, when I talk about increasing muscle mass and when I talk about building strength volume, that's a bit like the same way we talk about building aerobic fitness and building base aerobic fitness. Strength volume is the way I term higher repetition strength training that underpins my ability to do the more intense strength training that we see in the preseason. So that's what I mean when I talk about strength volume. So we, in the off season, we generally talk it's low to moderate intensity. We're not really doing really heavy weights. Generally, the repetition volume is a little bit higher. So what we tend to see is somewhere around 3 to 5 sets, 6 to 12 reps. It depends of course, a lot on the exercise, the equipment and stuff like that you have available. Generally, what I like to talk about is key lifts, what we call key lifts and accessory lifts. So key lifts are normally things like squats, things like deadlifts, things like bench presses, that kind of stuff. Accessory lifts is more, it might be our more single leg training type stuff. It might be more overhead presses. It might be more shoulder blade isolation work, this type of thing. So just to give you an idea roughly of what that session would look like. When we move down to kind of the pre-season, then of course we see the intensity go up. So we're generally looking at heavier weights, higher intensities. The volume is generally a little bit lower, so it's a bit more on the moderate kind of end of the spectrum. Of course, I still need to keep the frequency quite solid, but lifting reps wise, we're talking 3 to 4 sets of 3 to 8 reps. So we don't tend to go much higher than 8 reps if we want to work to develop our maximum strength. Generally, then we see, I do always start to include a little bit of explosive work into that, because it's almost like we keep a tiny bit of everything in at all points. So that's generally when I start to include that explosive work. Of course, the main emphasis, the bulk of the session then becomes around those key lifts. So those key exercises and the accessory lifts starts to reduce a little bit, 2 to 3 times per week. When we talk about in season, so keeping our strength ticking over and making sure we're increasing power. This is where the main thing to notice is probably around the lifting intensity. So that's where maybe the intensity of what we're doing, so the weight load starts to go down a little bit. And this is because then we're not focusing so much on the weight itself, but how quickly I can move that weight with a lot of those exercises. And that's where I get that development of power. And what we tend to see is somewhere around 2 to 5 sets of 3 to 6 reps. Again, depends a little bit on the exercise. Much more of an emphasis on those explosive lifts. Of course, I'm trying to work on transferring that velocity component. Still a little bit of work on key lifts, depending on what the session is and everything else, and a tiny bit of accessory work to keep that going, particularly if you may be missing muscle mass in certain areas, then you're going to want to keep doing a little bit on that area throughout the year.
Yes, I'm intrigued to know. Thank you very much for that information. Anyway, I'm a biologist, so I come from all this along the level at the level of what is this doing actually at the level of the microfibers of the muscles.
Yes, yeah.
To produce the adaptation that we want to achieve, and how does one detect as the user of the muscle whether one's got to the point where the muscles say, "Okay, I've got the message. If you do this to me again tomorrow, I'm going to grow another muscle shred." So when we're doing these exercises, is it to the point where the muscles simply can't do another repetition, either by lots of lightweights or a few heavyweights? What is it that triggers the adaptation at the cellular level? Because in a sense, once one understands that,
yeah, definitely,
one can tailor the exercises to reach the point where that particular muscle is sending a message that it's got the message. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. So it's one of those things. So how I look at the adaptations around strength training is some of that is at the muscular level and some of that is at the neuromuscular level. So a big amount of the power adaptations that we see are increases in things like rate coding, the capacity basically for my brain to send impulses to the muscle, how well the synchronicity is of that, and therefore how much of that muscle it can recruit in one go. That's what allows us to develop most of those kind of power adaptations and certainly some of the maximum strength adaptations that we see. So those, the kind of typical pre-season training that we do. So if I was to look at it in half, so if I took the table that I have here with off-season, pre-season, in-season, most of the neuromuscular adaptations that we see, that's generally in the training that we do in season and for probably half, let's say, of the preseason. It crosses over a little bit more than that. Of course, it's impossible to isolate these things because you know, the reality of the bioenergetic system is it's quite complex. I would say in the off season and certainly parts of the preseason is where we talk about generally more muscular level of adaptation. So when I want to build muscle mass, The biggest factor is around, I need quite a lot of volume. So I need to get the muscle to work for a good amount of time and then start to get it towards a fatigue state. Now, you don't necessarily have to have that muscle to go to failure for it to then send the signaling of, okay, I need to put down new muscle fibers. I think that's a little bit of a misconception, is that we have to work always to maximum in the gym to make sure we get the same adaptations. I don't think that's the case, but we do have to have the key mediating factor in terms of building muscle mass and encouraging my body to signal to put down more muscle fibers is firstly frequency and then the volume of work that I do within a session. But that's why I've specified those guidelines there.
So by frequency, you mean the number of times a week you subject the muscle to this experience?
Correct. Correct. That's right. Yeah. And obviously when I can't do it every day, and some bodybuilders obviously do that, but they're also taking other things to allow them to recover, to be able to then keep doing that consistently. The other way, Sean, that I like to think about it is how often I quite talk about it is I call like reps in the tank. So for example, we might be saying, Sean, okay, sure, we're going to do 3 sets of 8 repetitions on this exercise. What I want you to do is maybe pick a weight that you can do, let's say 10 repetitions with. So the exertion is actually quite solid. No, it's quite a high exertion, but it's not necessarily to failure. Does that make sense? That's also a good way, rather than, because sometimes with the people always ask me around there, what percentage and stuff should I use here? Actually, probably an easier way to explain that to some of you guys is actually say, in this training block, I want you to work off, let's say, 2 reps left in the tank for most of these exercises. And for this training block, I want you to work off 1 rep in the tank. And then maybe for the in-season training block, we're working something like 5 or 6 reps in the tank where we're focusing more on speed. If that makes sense.
Yep.
I don't know if that answers entirely your question. I think I could probably talk to you for about 2 or 3 hours about that bits, those bits just alone in terms of that deeper level, but that's a general conclusion of kind of what
it's based upon one's subjective assessment of when the muscle's getting to the point where it's telling us it doesn't want to lift this weight anymore. We've sent it the message.
Yeah, most of the time, yes. I don't think don't have to necessarily think about it as the muscle itself is how it works, because a lot of the exercises we tend to do are more kind of compound exercises. So they always cross multiple joints and use multiple muscle groups to be able to do the exercise. But it's generally just think about it in your own exertion. You're like, oh, okay, if I do this exercise, I could maybe do 2 or 3 more reps at this weight. I could do 0 reps at this weight. And then it becomes a maximum exertion, which is okay sometimes in training. But when we're training in the gym and we don't necessarily have to always go to that, I think that's the conception. So I have to go always to failure if I want to make progress in the gym, and it's not the case at all. But that's a good way to think about it, is to go, you know, how many more reps can I do at this exercise? And what I could do actually, Sean, at the end of this, I could probably give you an idea of, for each of those kind of key lifts, accessory lifts, what would be appropriate in terms of intensity when we talk about like reps in the tank, if that makes sense. And then you've got something a bit more pragmatic to go off. Cool. So the other bit to talk about was just around, I had this question quite a lot, particularly over the lockdown. Sean, you already alluded to this, just in terms of access to gym facilities at the moment is really difficult. So I made just like this little table just around what I think is the best kind of priority bits that you can get if you do want to invest in some of your own equipment. I'm not going to go into the details as to why every single bit is important, but I'm definitely going to cover the first bit, which is the definitely get bit. First up and foremost is a good yoga mat or an exercise mat. If you're doing most of your training maybe on your carpet or indoors on a fairly soft surface, you don't have to worry about this as much. But certainly if you're doing most of your training in your garage or something like that, then a mat's going to be pretty good. There's a lot of strength training that we can do with just our own body weight. In fact, there's so much that we can do with just our own body weight. It's going to be great for a lot of warm-up exercises, a lot of mobility stuff that we're also going to do. The second bit I would suggest is get either a couple of kettlebells or a couple of dumbbells. Generally go off one light and one heavy, and that's a kettlebell is often the first port of call I go to with someone who's new age training in the gym. is to start adding extra resistance to exercises. The first one, depending upon how strong you are, the heavier one, maybe you want around somewhere between 16 to 24 kilos. And the lighter one, probably around 8 to 16 kilos. Again, of course, depending on how strong you are. And yeah, the list is endless as to what you can do with them. You can do lots of variations of squats. We can do lots of loaded single leg training, things like swings. We can do some kind of upper body pressing work and pulling work as well. Of course, the other option is maybe get yourself, like, you can get some adjustable dumbbells that I've put on the other page that you can change the weights for a little bit easier. They're also a worthwhile investment if you're prepared to spend the money on them. The second thing I would get is maybe some resistance bands. So actually, resistance bands are super useful. Again, I would probably go off like a thicker, so one thicker band, it's probably roughly maybe an inch and a half thick, something like that. And then probably a thinner band that's looking like probably about an inch to half an inch thick is also really useful. And that just gives us good variety for lots of different things. Things like RDLs, again, a couple of variations of squats. I can do lots of pulling work with that type of stuff. Either a foam roller or a mobility ball is also a good investment. You just use like a lacrosse ball. You pick them up for a couple of bucks. They're really, really cheap, but again, really useful. Lots of different mobility stuff. Having something to do some self-massage work, I think, is really useful and a really good tool for recovery. And we can definitely use those things also for some other work. So lots of core work and stuff like that. Actually, a funny one is just an old bath towel. What I like to do with a lot of people that train at home is a lot of isometric training. And when you haven't got a load of like weights and stuff at home, isometric training is a really good way to work on our strength. It's quite low risk. There's not a huge amount of like necessarily like system body load, but I can get a lot of benefit in terms of developing strength. So, you know, isometric is ultimately where the muscle is contracting, but there's no movement taking place. So we can do things like isometric squats, isometric pulls and presses and that kind of stuff. But it's just really, all you need is just a bath towel. So it's a really inexpensive, useful piece of kit. And of course, if you have got someone to help you, a friend or a buddy is actually really good. There's a lot of exercises that we can just apply with like manual kind of resistance. Just getting your friend to like hold your legs down and stuff like that is really useful. Seems a bit of a silly one, but definitely worthwhile. Yeah. Just a couple of parting things from me, just to sum up. Of course, take the time to prioritize strength training. It's a really powerful tool for a lot of you guys. Work with someone. If you have got coaches or you've got rowing coaches, definitely work with them to try and prioritize it into your schedule. I think that's really useful. Of course, have a well-planned program. That certainly will optimize your best kind of performance through the season. I think the most important message is certainly stay safe in the gym. Focus on the basics and get support from a coach where you, if you need it. And if it's certainly an area you've not spent a lot of time doing before, having a coach to evaluate your movement and have a look at the right kind of program for you is really useful. So those would be the key things for me. I hope you've enjoyed the kits that we've gone through this evening. I hope I've given you something of an idea to go away and do.
It's been great. I've got a question about some of the key exercises. What would you say the big five that we need to do if we're short on time? What are the big five strength weightlifting movements?
Yeah, I think a little bit less of necessarily specific exercises. We always talk about those adaptations, I think, are key. I think the general patterns that I like to see in the gym is certainly a squat pattern. That can be, if you are someone who's really competent with training in the gym, that might be a back squat, it might be a front squat. It might be just what we call a goblet squat. So a squat with a kettlebell or the dumbbell just held at the chest. A squat pattern, I think, is really important. It covers a lot of the knee hip mobility that we need for the sport. And it's a big component of that key part of the catch and drive phase. The second bit to that would be some kind of hinging movement. Things like hip bridges, hip thrusts, Romanian deadlifts, where we're working that hinge movement. Now, that doesn't always have to be with a heavy barbell, but we can get a lot of benefit by doing that type of work with bands, with kettlebells, etc. The third one would probably be some kind of upper body pulling work. So something like an inverted row, something like a dumbbell row, a barbell row, whatever it might be, where we're working on squeezing the shoulder blades together and reinforcing that kind of strong back position and posture through the whole of the back. I would probably also include some upper body kind of pushing in that as well. Okay, it might be a bench press. It might be dumbbell bench presses. It might just be press ups.
A push up. Yeah,
press-ups. Exactly. Yeah, just it doesn't have to be those big kind of barbell exercises. Get so much from just doing the body weight type of work as well. A rule I have with the girls, for example, is 10 press ups before 10 kilos, which is got to be able to do 10 push ups before you can put 10 each side into the bar for the bench press. So the key mark is you've got to be able to handle your own body weight first. I would also, probably the last bit I would say, is some kind of single leg training for rowers, I think is really beneficial. It might be a lunge, step up, it might be split squat. Doesn't always matter what the exercise is itself, but those are probably the big five, I would say. Squat pattern, hinge pattern, upper body pull, upper body push, and single leg pattern. If you were doing those things 2 or 3 times a week, you can't really go wrong.
And then you can mix it up so you don't get bored, so you can just pick from one of those key patterns.
Yeah. So generally how I do it with the guys is I program from probably 2 to 5 weeks, actually. I might start the season, let's take the single leg work, for example. I might start the season with something quite stable, so like split squat. And then I might work up to maybe like a barbell loaded reverse lunge, maybe from a small step as well, to make it a little bit more challenging for them movement wise. But so what tends to happen is I'll work like fixed exercises for 2 to 5 weeks, and then I'll change some bits, not everything, because some exercises like pull-ups, for example, that they stay throughout the year. But some of the accessory stuff, I rotate a little bit more. But yeah, that's a little bit I just do it because that's my job, and that's how I put these things together. But it's no necessarily exact recipe as to what's the correct way to do it.
The Australian Olympic Center in Gavarantie doesn't have any machines. It's all free weights. It's bars, it's dumbbells, it's kettlebells, etc. I know in Sanand it's pretty much the same. Why is that? A lot of gyms have a lot of fixed machines. Should we be doing free weights? Should we be doing using machines? What's your thoughts there?
I think my opinion is that generally free weights have the best transfer. So they're much more, they always like the term functional, but they have the most kind of functional transfer into sporting movements. And to be honest, they have the most functional transfer into sporting life and into life as well. I think that's a frustrating thing is that particularly with older folks, we have this almost like fragile approach, really safe on these machines. The machine ends up doing most of the loading for you. It only really loads in, if I'm doing like a lat pull down, only really gets heavy from about here where I do a little bit of work. And it's not load up joints too much. But the reality is that in order for the joint to get stronger and to be more mobile, healthier, I need some load to stimulate it. It's like I said before, poison is the cure. We always got to be sensible with how much we do at any one time. But certainly I would say for almost any population, a free weight training is going to be more beneficial. And I think what we're seeing from most of the health research, so the bits around the kind of sarcopenia stuff, is that we find that free weight's generally more effective.
And just one more question about the old bench pull versus a bent over row. We have seen a lot of rib injuries when they're just loading up the bench pull. And I know also with the masters, it's not so comfortable doing that. Do you have any opinion there? Bent over row, single arm row versus lying on a sweaty
cushion? Yeah. It's a good question. It's quite often brought up. I would say generally with most kind of rib injuries, if you take the rowing out of the equation and the guys were just training on the bench pull, you probably wouldn't see the same issues. Like most rib injuries are quite specific to the motion of the sport and they accrue over a period of time. You don't just rock up to one session and break the rib. It's a training load that's building over a period of a few months. A bench pull can really aggravate because you're lying on the rib and you're in a position where those key muscle groups that you need in that movement are loading up the rib cage as well. So it ends up being a lot of stress on the rib cage. I'm not necessarily averse to bench pulls. I'm not a huge fan of them. I generally like a bent over row a little bit more because it links posture into the pulling motion at the same time.
It's loading the hinging movement too, aren't you? You're really getting that extra stress.
But Yeah. You could also, if I had that same conversation with Jürgen Grober, he absolutely loves a bench pull. So there's no way if I was working with the British team, I wouldn't keep it in my programming. But yeah, I don't think there's a wrong or I think there's a right decision for the right situation and for the right person, I would say to that.
Thank you, James. Now, Mark, you're training, I think, for the head of the Charles later on. Did you have any questions about strength training for that more head distance race?
I do. Thank you. And actually, the one question I was most interested in hearing your take on is actually in the recovery between weight training sessions. Thinking about this from the frame of a master's rower, is there any science or sort of your personal thoughts on what to do between the weight sessions in terms of just rest, do what feels good to you? Is there anything beneficial about systematic foam rolling, massage, or just do what you think feels best for your body?
Yes. And so generally, I think the key element is you've already touched upon is doing what feels better for you is probably the most beneficial thing. I think that's the most impactful thing. Now, in terms of like actual recovery between weight sessions, fueling is really critical. Having a decent amount of protein intake post-weight session and actually what happens is my body's in a state where it's had a load of muscle tissue broken down, has an inflammatory response. So I need to put down new proteins. Where am I going to get that from? And that's where the fueling element comes in. So the nutrition aspect is definitely really key. Sleep is a massive factor. That's a huge one on weight training. I would say like trying to make sure you prioritize sleep post recovery of strength training is really key. I would probably avoid stuff like quite severe kind of interventions. So things like ice baths, cold water immersion, that stuff I would probably leave out when I'm focusing on strength training, because there's some evidence to suggest that if you interfere too much with those adaptation pathways, you can actually blunt some of the gains that you get from doing the training. So I'd be careful with that stuff. I would probably avoid like heavy stretching. I would probably avoid light stretching, no problems, like yoga type movements, and light foam rolling is also going to be fine. But yeah, you just have to let it take its course. But I think a lot of people are quite put off because the first time they do some strength training, they might get like really bad, call it DOMS, so delayed onset muscle soreness. They might get that really bad. And then that puts them off doing any strength training again, which is really unfortunate because, you know, you can definitely do a more sensible introductory program than that. You could certainly, like, once you've had that really bad muscle soreness one time, it's very rare that you get it as bad again. So your tolerance kind of to it gets really good. But yeah, it's a good question.
Thank you very much.
Sean, any more questions?
Hello, James. Thanks for the talk. Just, you mentioned about nutrition during the adaptation stage after the exercise. Is there any role for protein supplements? Are they rubbish, or there's some to be avoided or some to be taken in the aftermath of a weight session?
I think for yourself, Sean, actually, it's probably not a bad idea. I think it depends a little bit on what your diet is. Of course, we generally have a food first approach. So we encourage as much guys to get as much as they can and maximize from their food intake. But there is definitely a role for that. I would say trying to prioritize getting some protein on board as quick as the weight sessions is quite valuable. But ultimately, the thing that's the most influential factor is actually having enough protein in the period after weight training. So the kind of the 24 to 48 hours post weight training, where your body is rebuilding those tissues, rebuilding those proteins, the total protein intake that you consume over that is the most influential thing. Obviously, of course, protein sources are generally meats, eggs, fish, dairy, that kind of stuff. A little bit harder if you're maybe on more of a vegetarian diet, but not certainly not impossible. So yeah, that's what I'd say is the main factor. You can, of course, if you're not maybe getting enough of that from your diet, then supplements are definitely a good idea. They are sometimes the marketing is necessarily a little bit stronger than what the benefits always are.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
No problem.
Fueling afterwards, it really is key. So Sean and Mark, you both touched on a key thing. Sean, I like to get, if I'm going directly to work or I'm not coming home to have a sandwich or dinner or whatever, I'll definitely be having a protein shake. And I'm with James 100% there. A lot of it is marketing guff, but then some of it is going to be doing me some benefit. So definitely do that. Mark, I like to take a day in between, but during the winter, I like to do a split routine. So I'll be working upper body one day, lower body the next day. And I'm always every day getting into a positive habit of doing some core strength. First thing in the morning, some push-ups, some air squats, some lunges, some plank, just to get in the mindset of constantly strengthening and hardening the body to go into battle later on. I think it's highly beneficial. A lot of material coming. James, you've done a great job. That's a fantastic masterclass. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, mate. That was, it was enjoyable. I hope I was able to answer most of your questions, guys.
Takeaway. That's really helpful, James. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, James.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
Join me next time when I'll be talking with one of the rowing world's most interesting people. And if you like this episode, you can subscribe so you never miss an episode in the future. Oh, and please, if you like it, leave us a 5-star review. That really helps us out. You can find out more about our unique training system and high-performance coaching by visiting whchambers.com.